Namaste and welcome to the Om Som Yoga and Ayurveda podcast.
A space to dive into how we as humans can live more intentional, ethical and sustainable lives.
And how we can come into harmony with ourselves, others and nature in the process.
We share tips to help you cultivate a healthy body, calm mind and a strong purpose through the traditional Vedic wisdom of yoga and Ayurveda.
My name is Aaron Petty. I'm a yoga teacher, a teacher trainer, a yoga therapist. But most importantly, I am a student of this incredible tradition.
And my name is Paige Taylor. I'm a yoga teacher, an Ayurvedic health consultationer, advocate for sustainable living and lover of all beings.
And on today's podcast, we know it's been a little while, but we wanted to offer something to blend the two worlds that we're all currently experiencing, the world of Christmas and the world of yoga. And we wanted to tap into what the yoga tradition says or holds in relation to Christmas and look at how we can draw some parallels between what is seemingly a public holiday or the end of the year or, you know, the time that everyone gets off work, and what is traditionally a religious holiday.
Interesting.
And a spiritual celebration of sorts. But first, I think I wanted to start around our experience of Christmas in the last couple of years. Because I think as we've grown up a little bit and become adults, we've almost become a little dispassionate about Christmas.
I think for me as well, it also started when I, you know, changed my diet to a more vegetarian or vegan diet. My views changed around consumerism. My views changed around so much that, yeah, it almost feels like Christmas is a time where family just like picks on us a little bit or like we get like our views and experiences of the world in the current state get like pushed down a little bit in order to I guess fit in with
the norm of society
and I think that is why maybe we have become a little dispassionate or a little bit disempowered around the holiday of Christmas. And last year we just said
we quit
effort and we ran away. So we didn't celebrate Christmas at all. We actually had a picnic on the beach, just the two of us.
Yeah.
Which was a lot of fun, but you can't really run from these things forever. And yes, last year was a bit of a more turmoil.
Tumultuous
time, and this year feels like it's settling a little bit. So
And I think just with the climate of COVID and everything last year, that all added to it.
Totally.
And at the same time, as we grow older, I think that we lose a little bit of the magic of Christmas. That, like, I remember when I was a kid, coming up to Christmas time, it was like, you know, the most joyous time of the year because I got so many presents and I got to see my grandparents and they would be giving me presents and, you know, I think I was very blessed in my upbringing in that way. I know that not everyone has had that experience of Christmas. I think for a lot of people, Christmas could bring up feelings of lack where they would see all their friends getting all of these gifts and presents and have their family. And, you know, someone may have come from a little less of a fortunate situation. But yeah, I think just coming from that place personally, that Christmas was always such an abundant time in my family and a time for celebration and everyone coming together. I think, it was exciting for me as a kid. And then as I grew up a little bit, I started hearing about, you know, the family politics around Christmas, who's going to take the kids on this day, where's the lunch going to be? And then it just became, you know, we have to go here for Christmas Eve, here for Christmas Day, here for Christmas dinner, here for Boxing Day. And then especially when you add a partner into that situation, I'm trying to navigate between my family and Paige's family. And then on top of that, yeah, the last couple of years we've been really looking into the consumerism around Christmas and how it's just a buy extravaganza. And we realized that the gifts that we were getting were just most of the time just plastic crap that was going to go in the bin in a couple of months. And it was just for the you know,
the sake,
the giving of, yeah, the sake of giving a present or the sake of buying something.
Mm.
And on top of that, I think as a business owner, someone who's been self-employed for the past 5 years, I don't have thousands of dollars to go and spend money on pointless presents for my family.
Mm, totally.
And so, yeah, the last couple of years, we've kind of taken a bit of a stronger stance against how Christmas is celebrated in our friendship group or in our family groups. And we've tried to direct that in a way that is more aligned with the lifestyles that we live.
Mm, totally.
And so for the last few years, we've had this idea that's been hot. Like it's kind of like the words I come back to when Christmas comes around, especially in the studio. And it's presence over presence. Mm. That instead of giving presents, we spend time in each other's presence.
Mm.
That the best gift that you can give sometimes is that complete presence. You know, your phone's down. Mm. You're not talking about yourself. You're just here with this person that you love and you're spending time, you know, loving each other.
Totally. And I think at the end of the day, that's all that we all really want out of it. But I think that, you know, as we begin to speak a little bit more in this podcast, like so many people have different love languages and different ways of expressing themselves. And I think we've just gotten a little trapped in this one specific love language of gifting that has made it a little harder for the people that aren't the gift givers or struggling in that world to feel adequate maybe and supported during this time of Christmas.
Yeah, and that, you know, for some people just that, yeah, even receiving gifts is not what's fulfilling. That some of us, what we want to receive is, you know, just some quality time spent with 100%. Our family without the stresses of where it has to be. I wish everyone could just come together in one place.
Mm.
And so we've always tried to do that at the studio to create a space that's, you know, not gift forwards, but presence forwards. And at the same time, I've really been enjoying exploring the historical context of Christmas over the last few years.
Mm.
And it's been something that's really like changed my perspective on this time of year and why we all take this time off to celebrate. Mm. And yeah, it's been a very interesting thing to unpack for myself, especially from my own upbringing. I was brought up, as you guys know, in a Christian school, and the church services were always kind of like shoved down our throat. I remember even like kindergarten. Did you do like a nativity play in kindergarten?
Mm-hmm.
That like there is a side of Christmas that gets pushed onto us as children.
Mm.
And I think for me personally, because it was so overpowering, I would always kind of shy away from that side of it. That I would focus more about the presents and, you know, giving gifts and buying gifts and spending the most amount of money, as opposed to the qualities that Christmas represents, which is like those Christ-like qualities.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, let alone just being a child and being exposed to those kind of experiences can be hard to grapple and hard to understand, let alone, you know, being in a family or a school that, like, do they really understand the essence of it? You know, they put you in this school play or in this Christian school for your upbringing, but like, do they really understand like the tradition of that Christmas period? Like, it would be very hard, and it was, I assume, and for me as well, very hard to grapple with that understanding of what Christmas is further than the presents, especially as a child. And so
we think about Christmas as being the celebration of the birth of Christ, or the birth of Jesus. And we've all seen that nativity scene where, what is it, like the three wise men. I'm probably not the best person to be describing the nativity scene. I probably haven't seen it since I was six.
It doesn't matter.
Three wise men come in, angels come in, Joseph and Mary can't get into the hotel, so they have to stay in the barn overnight, and then they say that the Christ is going to be born, and then Jesus is born, and it's this big, incredible, godly incarnation in the human form.
Mm.
And then we have this incredible life story of Jesus.
Mm. And before you check out of this podcast that we're talking about Jesus or Christianity, just know that there's so much more than what maybe you've had shoved down your throat in schooling or other experiences about this religion, and that when we explore it in ways that we're going to chat about today, although it may feel triggering for you and that experience is completely valid, just know that there's so much more to this than appears on the surface, and that in so many traditions that Jesus was actually a yogi. And that's what we're going to dive into a little bit today.
Yeah, so it's interesting because we never really hear about any of this stuff. And when I came into yoga, I came into yoga around the physical practice, like most of us do. And then I started to slowly become exposed to these more esoteric spiritual teachings. And in India, they hold this very firm belief that there were, is it 9 incarnations of Vishnu? Mm. And Vishnu is kind of like the nourishing, sustaining, nurturing force of nature. And when they talk about gods and goddesses, they're talking about a state of awareness or a specific divine personality.
Mm.
And so what they say is that one of these incarnations of Vishnu was Jesus.
Mm.
That this Christly incarnation was the same God that incarnated as Krishna and Rama and all of these other 9 or whatever number it is, incarnations.
Mm.
And so there's a story along the missing years in the life of Christ.
Mm. And before you go on, like, if you haven't done much diving into the deities of Hinduism or the gods and goddesses that we speak of in the yoga tradition, know that it's not only a force that is external of yourself and that you have to look up to and work towards, which is what a lot of Western religion is kind of encouraged as. But this Eastern sense of religion is these aspects or these states of awareness, as Aaron mentioned, are actually accessible within us.
Mm.
And so these different personalities that are given as Vishnu, Krishna, Rama, Jesus, these are all just personality traits that we can resonate with as human beings, and then we can, you know, begin to move towards, begin to cultivate, begin to embody.
Yeah, and that Jesus isn't, you know, a little man with long hair and a beard and sandals that we should be worshipping, but he is an example or an analogy for qualities that exist within every human.
Mm.
And that when we look to these deities, we're not looking at this almighty that's, you know, judging us at all times. We're looking at something that is reflecting something that's deep within us, something that's pure and divine and spiritual in nature. And so in this story of Jesus, many of us have heard these different stories of Jesus through the Bible, but there is a missing section of Jesus' life that's not described in the Bible. And basically, it's from when he was 13 to when he was 29. Mm. They don't know where he went. And so in 1887, and I'm going to read straight off the iPad for this because I don't want to mess it up. But in 1887, there was a man named Nicholas Notovich, and he claimed that when he went to India in Ladakh, he had learned of a document called The Life of Saint Issa. And Issa was the Arabic name of Jesus.
Mm.
And so the story was basically translated into French, and he named it The Unknown Life of Jesus Christ. And according to these scrolls, Jesus had abandoned Jerusalem at the age of 13, and he set out toward India, intending to improve and perfect himself in the divine understanding and to study the laws of the great Buddha.
Mm.
It's said that he crossed the Punjab and reached Puri Jagannath, where he studied the Vedas under Brahmin priests. He spent 6 years in Puri and, how do you say that, do you reckon? Rajgir?
Yeah.
And he spent some time in the ancient seat of Hindu learning. And then he went to the Himalayas and he spent time in Tibetan monasteries studying Buddhism. And he went through Persia, returning to Jerusalem at the age of 29. And so the story goes that there was a lost scripture that had been uncovered in the 1800s, and it described this period of Jesus's life that was previously unaccounted for. And there was a lot of people trying to discredit it at the time, and supposedly it has been found, like someone found a second copy of it, like the original copy of it before the translation. But all of the monks in the monastery were kind of denying its existence. So it's a bit of a Celestine prophecy kind of story. So I think still like the kind of Orthodox Christian churches are kind of denying this knowledge. But in India, like Jesus as a deity is massive.
Oh, massive. Yeah, for
absolutely
sure.
Absolutely massive.
Especially in the south.
Yeah. So I'm going to continue on with the story a little bit. Basically, in Jesus's time, there were two major groups of Judaism. One that had very strict laws and rituals, and they had a very specific way that they had to study God. And then the other group kind of believed that God was unknowable. Now, Jesus was a part of a third group called the Essenes or Essines, and the name Essein means the outsiders. And so basically they were a religious group that existed outside the two powers that were. And their contact, this group that Jesus was a part of, with the Brahmins in India formed very specific ways that they would conduct themselves. And it was very prominent the way that the Indian customs influenced the customs of Jesus and his followers. So there's a couple things, and I'm just going to lay out a list and then we'll unpack them a little bit. But I want you to just think maybe yamas and niyamas of the yogic philosophy, and just listen how these different ways that Jesus and his followers conducted themselves can draw parallels to the yamas and niyamas. So number one, they practiced strict non-violence, so ahimsa. Number two, they were absolute vegetarians and would not touch alcohol in any form. Number three, they refused to wear anything of animal origin, such as leather or wool, and they would usually make their clothes out of linen. Number four, they rejected animal sacrifice. Number five, they interpreted the Hebrew scriptures in an almost exclusively spiritual, symbolic, and metaphysical manner. So it wasn't literal translations. Number six, celibacy was prized by them, sometimes being observed even in marriage. And many of them led monastic lives in total renunciation. They considered male and female members, all of whom were literate, to be spiritual equals, and both sexes were prophets and teachers among them. This too was the practice in Hinduism at that time. They denied the doctrine of the physical resurrection of the dead at the end of time. That's like the zombie apocalypse. I think that was like a big belief back then. They believed in reincarnation and the law of karma and the ultimate reunion of the soul with God. They believed that the sun was a divine manifestation imparting spiritual powers to both the body and mind. They faced the rising and setting sun and recited prayers of worship, refusing upon rising in the morning to speak a single word until the conclusion of their prayers. They believed in both divination and the powers of prophecy. They believed in the power of occult formulas or mantras, as well as esoteric rituals. They believed in astrology, cast horoscopes and made magical amulets of plants and gems according to their astrological aspects, which sounds very
Vedic
to me. They also believed in herbalism. They believed that the miraculous cures were natural extensions of authentic spiritual life. Mm. They would wear only white clothes as a sign that they worshipped God, who is light, and were clothed by him in light. They observed the identical rules of purity, known as saucha, as the Brahmins in India at the time. They practiced the strictest adherence to truthfulness, which is satya. And so basically the rules of the organization that Jesus and his followers were a part of are basically identical to the yamas and niyamas that we practice in yoga.
And maybe we can put some sources of where you've gotten all this information in the show notes if people feel
totally.
The need
I can
to
send through some reading for sure.
Yeah.
So I think it's just so interesting that the practices that were being observed by not only the Hindu Brahmins, but also the Buddhists of that time were being brought over to the West by Jesus and his followers, and they were the teachings.
Mm.
That was the essence of Jesus's teaching. It's identical to the teaching of yoga, that you are the divine, that your awareness is pure, and that if you on the daily spend time practicing, cultivating pure loving qualities, then your life will be the manifestation of that.
Powerful.
And so if we look at it from this perspective, Christmas time is not about the church and the church that was, the church that I grew up in, that was controlling everything that you did, but it's about liberation, right? And truly, it's about love. It's about coming together with the people that you love and loving them, you know, and caring for them and spending time with them. And so if Christmas is about love, then what is love? And I think to answer this question, we wanted to lean into the yoga tradition as well as some more modern ideas, as well as our own interpretations. As normal, because that's what we like to do. So, Paige, what does love mean to you?
Love is a state of connection, of pure presence and seeing. It's this state of utter trust and respect that is a two-way street.
Reciprocity.
Yeah, for sure.
I love that. And I love how it's been described to me many times that like Hatha yoga is that reciprocity between the inhale and the exhale. Love always has, you know, this relationship implied, you know, relationship between two people, relationship between inhale and exhale. It's that intrinsic collaboration between two opposing forces that brings about good feelings. And so we often talk about this in our yoga classes and in our trainings. We talk about collaboration, how if something within that relationship is overpowering, then the loving dynamic goes out of balance. And that in order to bring that relationship back into balance, we need to cultivate reciprocity. We talk about in the breath between the inhale, the exhale. We talk about it in the energies between the prana and the apana. We talk about it in Hatha yoga between the ha and the tha, the sun and the moon. And in context of our own relationships, you know, between me and you, Paige, there needs to be a certain balance and understanding for us to make the most of our time together. Otherwise, it just blows up into an argument. Which would never happen between two. And so I think the big lie that society has told us is the difference between being in love and being in love is the way that I like to describe it. And so to be in love with someone in the context of our society means what? That you buy them a bunch of flowers, you take them on a first date, you learn their favorite color and their birthday and their grandma's name, you learn what kind of food they like, and then you live in a house together. And so long as you remain the person that that person fell in love with, then nothing could possibly go wrong. Now, what I've seen through my own experience is that when we start to change in relationships, then the love really gets tested. Because all of a sudden, if I want to start acting differently, or if I want to start to become, you know, a different person to what I was when I met you, and you're not willing to allow me the space to change, then all of a sudden the love is revoked. And I think for a lot of us, that's been taught to us from a young age, that like, if I don't meet your expectations, then you will revoke your love, and then I will all of a sudden again be loveless. You know, it's kind of how our parents teach us, you know, don't cry in the supermarket, otherwise I won't love you anymore. You'll be a naughty little boy. And isn't that just how God was presented to me in high school? Oh my God. I've never really thought about it like that, but it was like, God loves you all the time, except for when you sin. Then God hates you and he'll cast you down into hell and you'll burn into ashes forever.
Oh dear.
And so yoga teaches us to cultivate love within ourselves first. That love is not someone else accepting you conditionally. That love is a state of awareness that is complete acceptance. It's radical acceptance. That I can accept every single part of you, even the dark and disgusting parts. even the parts that aren't so comfortable, that I can still love you through that. And that there's this knowingness that on the other side, I will still be there. And so the journey really has to begin with learning to love ourselves. Can I learn to love the darkest, most uncomfortable parts of me?
And I think this is an interesting topic because I was just reading something today about someone that I follow, and she was saying that she doesn't love her body because it feels, and she feels like the self-love movement is a little overwhelming because it seems unreachable for her. And so she was expressing this idea of like body neutrality, that it's like, I don't love my body, but I'm neutral about it. And it was just a thought-provoking thing. And I think what came up for me just then as you were speaking about that was like, what actually does it mean to love yourself and accept yourself fully? And I think what it comes down to for me is just complete presence. And it's what I teach in every one of my yoga classes is, can you just take a moment to sit and feel and notice how you experience yourself physically, mentally, emotionally? And there just doesn't need to be any judgment. There doesn't need to be any criticalness or wanting to fix or change anything. It's just this sense of total acceptance and presence with yourself in that moment.
I love that page. And I fully see that like, you know, my body's not perfect. And that's just like, it's the societal beauty standards perhaps in this like, and I even experienced that as a man. Like, I don't have rock hard popping abs and a big chest. And so, yeah, it's not that I have to, you know, idolize myself. It's not that I have to be completely self-absorbed, but at least I am at a place where I don't hate my body.
Yeah. And
that I accept it.
Accepting. Yeah.
Yeah. Totally. In a neutral way.
Because in the end, at the end of the day, all love is acceptance and presence. But I think we have almost this spin on love that it's like
adoration
and nourishment. And like, you know, if you love your body, then you better be putting away, you know, an hour every day to self massage yourself in these luxurious oils and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then if you don't create those kind of practices for yourself, then do you really love your body? I don't know. That kind of pressure from especially social media, like self-love practice, self-love day, that like, how can we experience that in every moment without needing to be over the top.
Yeah. And I think that it really comes down to finding clarity.
Mm.
Finding clarity around how do I best receive love?
Mm. And finding clarity on love in general for yourself.
What is love for me? What is the feeling of love? What is the experience of love? And how can I generate that within myself?
Yes.
Without the need for someone else?
Or something else.
Yeah, because we've all become so dependent on external sources of love and validation.
Mm-hmm.
Especially with social media, we get the little love hearts.
Mm-hmm.
It's falsifying it. Mm. And so if you can take that time to be alone, to learn to love within yourself and not to you know, love bomb yourself, which is kind of a narcissistic way of loving.
Well, not really.
But to fully accept yourself.
We don't have to shun the self-love movement. You can totally love bomb yourself and you can totally, you know, take an hour luxurious massage. Like some days that's me for sure. And that's
me every day.
And that's valid, yeah. But like for some people that might be unreachable and inaccessible and a little intimidating.
Yeah.
And so how can we show up in a way that's loving without all that jingle bells and ribbons?
Yeah. And I think that's what Christmas kind of traps us in sometimes. Like there's many different ways to love, but Christmas traps us in the paradigm that loving is giving and receiving gifts.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, if I don't have the means to give or receive gifts, then I feel like I am void of love.
Mm.
And I think for a lot of people, Christmas leaves that big hole.
Totally.
You know, perhaps there's something that's not the same anymore. You don't have that capacity to give and receive gifts.
Mm.
And so it can be very uncomfortable.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people can give gifts at the expense of their own like mental health, their own financial health. And that big hole at the end is like in their experience. And I think that's just so hard, you know, to have the pressure to, you know, spoil your kids or spoil people that are in your life when you don't even have the artha, the financial means to spoil yourself. And I think that's a really tough reality of this holiday.
Yeah, totally.
And yeah, you're exactly right. It is just trapping us in this love language of giving and receiving without really acknowledging all the different love languages that are out there. And we were speaking about this with one of our students and friends after class yesterday, about how, yeah, she was saying she's not really a gift giver. And we were like, wow, that's really interesting, you know, like that there's this whole holiday around this. And like, what about the rest of us that aren't?
Gift givers.
And I am a gift giver. Like I love giving gifts and being thoughtful in that way. But yeah, to see that the other side of it, that some people really struggle with that. That's a real, what is it called? Reality check. Yeah.
All right. So let's have a talk about the love languages. Mm. So the idea is that there's five love languages, and maybe you've heard about this before. It's a pretty hot topic at the moment. But the five love languages, you may not have known, but they came from a pastor named Gary Chapman in America. And so I read somewhere that he called them like the five love languages of God.
Oh.
And so he kind of went at it with this kind of almost religious spin, but he came across these when he was doing like marriage counseling and he realized very quickly, or perhaps over a long period of time, maybe one or the other, but he realized that not all people give and receive love in the same way. And so he came up with these five languages, and perhaps they could help you during Christmas to establish what is the best way for you to give and receive love if it's not gifts. And so obviously one of the love languages, and we'll just call it the first one, is giving and receiving gifts. That's that I come home from my work day with a bunch of flowers and I give it to Paige and that says I love you. Or it's, you know, giving a Christmas gift to my mom to say I love you. So that's number one of five. Number 2 of 5 is called acts of service. Mm. Acts of service is like I am going down to my parents' house to mow the lawns, to give my dad a hand, mm. to tell my dad that I love him.
Mm.
Yeah. Something like that. Or, you know, for Paigey, maybe I'm working at my desk and she brings me, you know, some food. Mm. Just like a simple act of service to say, hey, I love you. I'm here to support you.
Mm.
Something simple like that. And so perhaps your Christmas present to someone could be going to clean your grandmother's gutters for her.
Yeah.
You know? Or it could be washing someone's windows, or it could be installing a new door in mm. their house or something like that, or painting their living room mm. for them. That could be just as well received as a present that you bought from Kmart.
If not better.
The third love language is physical touch.
Mm.
And some people are just huggers. They love a big, good hug. And that reciprocity of physical touch is how they express love to, mm. to people. I have many friends that come and hug me. And, you know, it's almost a little strange sometimes when it's men that just want to give you a big hug. But mm-hmm. there's so many friends of mine that are just like big, loving men, and they just want to hug
sweet.
Me because they love me. Mm. Yeah, I think it's really sweet too. Mm. So that's number 3, physical touch. Number 4 is quality time. I think for me, quality time is probably my favorite. That like, especially with friends, I don't want to go to their birthday mm. party and spend time with 40 other people to say happy birthday to them. I want to go and spend quality time with that person. I want to take them out for dinner, or I want to have them over for dinner.
Mm.
And I want to spend time one-on-one to see mm. how they've been going.
Yeah.
And yeah, so maybe that Christmas time is the time where you create some one-on-one time with the people that you love.
Mm.
So that's number 4. And then number 5 is words of affirmation. And so this is literally telling someone that you love them. Mm. And this could be another one for Christmas. Like you could pick everyone in your family and just write them a love letter.
Yeah.
You write them, you know, this big card, and maybe you decorate it and you write a list of all the things that you love about that person.
Mm-hmm.
That could be your love language.
Mm.
And so any of those 5 represent ways that you both give love and receive love. And sometimes the way that you give love and the way that you receive love is a little bit different.
Yeah, and I was going to almost say that, I mean, apart from physical touch, I feel like any of these love languages would be received well from anyone.
Yeah,
I mean, you can't speak for everyone in terms of physical touch. But in terms of the other things, you know, like there's nothing that's nicer than a beautiful card full of handwritten notes from people that you love, or somebody trying to spend time with you, or your family, an act of service or even a gift that like even if we just have one way of offering or expressing love in these languages, it's maybe a little bit easier to receive.
Yeah, and then I think that if you know how you best receive love,
mm-hmm.
so let's say for me, the best way for me to receive love is acts of service.
Mm.
Perhaps instead of writing a list of Christmas things that I want, mm. you know, like, you know, I don't know what I want.
It doesn't matter.
A new cup or a new car, whatever. I can say, actually, I would like for all of my family to come over and help me build this new fence that I need to build.
Mm.
Or I want all my family to come over and just help me clean my house for mm. the afternoon.
Yeah. Like
you could ask for that from your family.
Yeah.
As a present.
And the power of asking for what you need, like most of the time, the people that you love will do whatever that, you know, like would drop anything to support you in that way.
Yeah.
And that by simply just asking for what you need and what you want, not only do you save on the consumerism side of Christmas and maybe getting a gift that you're not ever actually going to use, or somebody spending money that's unnecessary on you, that you can actually just invite people to support you in the way that you need. And in doing so, that supports them as well.
Yeah.
And it takes the pressure out of it.
Yeah, it takes the pressure out of it for everyone because we are more clear on what we need and how we can give and receive. Mm. And, you know, if someone really, really wants to buy you a gift, maybe it's that you just ask them to write you a love letter or, you know, hand make you something.
And the chances of them, like somebody really, really wanting to buy you a gift is that they probably already have an idea of what they want to gift you. Yeah. And so that's fine too.
Yeah. And then also just like that you have to realize that for some people, gift giving is their love language. Mm. And so for that auntie or grandma or grandpa who's giving you the gift, even though you don't want gifts this year, you have to realize that that's just them showing love.
Mm.
That's just how they show love to you. And if you can receive it, just like just knowing that it's coming from a really loving place can be just as sweet.
And knowing that it's not the gift itself. That is the
the act of giving.
Yeah, exactly. It's like not. It doesn't matter what the gift is. It's just the essence of them giving you something that they've thought for themselves would suit you. Is the gift of love and taking that in with you for the Christmas period could be really helpful.
Yeah. Oh, I love it. It's like really lightened Christmas for this kind of stuff. That like it was really heavy a couple of years ago. I was really just like, this is terrible, what the world has done to Christmas. Mm. But looking at it through this lens, it's really lightened the load.
Mm.
So I guess the last thing that we wanted to leave you guys with as a reflection from the yoga tradition, it's actually probably a little more prevalent in Buddhist circles at the moment.
Mm.
But this is the four qualities of true love. So how do we know that love is true? By the presence of these four qualities. And in Buddhism, it's actually the four qualities that they teach you to cultivate through your meditation practice.
Mm.
That at the end of the day, if we are sitting down for meditation, the intention should be to become a more loving person.
Mm. Beautiful.
And so they go on to describe these four qualities of love as qualities that we should be looking to cultivate within ourselves.
Mm.
And so perhaps we can just leave you with these four qualities of true love as something to ponder and also cultivate during the Christmas period.
Mm. And if you've been practicing with us in studio, we've been exploring them the last few weeks to get you nice and ready for the Christmas period.
Okay, so the first one and probably the most famous one is called Metta.
Or Maitri.
Or Maitri. And it's not coined by Facebook. Hopefully we don't get banned from Facebook for saying Metta in this context.
It's got two T's.
Metta means loving kindness and compassion. It's more so forgiveness.
Mm.
And there's this meditation that we teach that so many people love. Where we are
spoiler alert.
We're giving loving kindness to someone who we don't like.
And more, but don't spoil the practice.
If you go on our YouTube channel,
I'm sure. Yeah, I think it's on there.
Yoga for self-love, you'll be able to do that meditation.
Yeah, practice. Go and do it for yourself. If you've never done a metta meditation, you should definitely, as soon as this episode's finished and you're not driving, go and do that.
Go and practice our Yin Yoga for self-love practice.
Yeah, it does something.
It's a love hack. It's our most popular YouTube video.
If you want to love bomb yourself today, that's the way to do it.
Okay, so metta is loving kindness. That if we are cultivating love within ourselves, we need to be kind to people.
Mm.
And there's so many people, you see it everywhere. You know, they go to the shops and they just abuse the person because they don't have the ice cream machines broken or they don't have hot chips at McDonald's. Mm. So number one, if you want to be loving, be kind.
Mm.
And forgiveness is the second part of that you need to develop the capacity to forgive the people who have wronged you.
Mm-hmm.
Think about the story of Jesus. When he was being nailed to the cross, do you think he was just staring at the Israelites, looking at them like, can't believe you would nail me to this damn thing, you damn dirty dogs? He wasn't. He was looking at them with compassion. He was like, I understand your context. I understand where you're coming from. I understand why you have to do this. I know you're just doing your job. I still love you.
Hmm.
Anyway, that was a long story. Number one, loving kindness. Just be nice to people.
Mm.
Number two is karuna, which is compassion. And this is probably a little more in line with my story that I just rambled off. But karuna means compassion. And that is the capacity to hold the context of another person's life. I understand why you are doing what you are doing because you're just doing the best that you can with what you have. That's compassion. It's understanding that you are you and you are acting the way that you act because of the circumstances that have been provided to you.
Mm-hmm.
That you can hold other people and love them even though they are doing things that you don't agree with.
Mm-hmm.
That's called karuna. The third quality of true love that we should be developing is called mudita. And mudita means vicarious joy. What does vicarious mean? It's something that's shared.
Mm.
That if Paige is happy, then I'm happy. If you're happy, then I'm happy. That I take joy in witnessing the joy of others.
Mm.
I think it's incredible. Really? I think so often we compare ourselves. Instead of celebrating the people around us, we're comparing ourselves to the people around us. Oh, that person's making more money than me. Oh, that person's got a nicer car than me. Oh, that person has more followers than me. That comparison that is just so rampant, especially when we have access to social media and we're just looking at everyone's highlight reels, that comparison will continually strip away the joy in our lives.
Mm.
And so in order to cultivate this essence of mudita, we need to truly start to cultivate happiness for the happiness of others.
Mm.
Like ask someone, what did you do that was a win this week? And when they say, oh, I went to the gym 3 times and I feel really good about myself, you say, wow, that's incredible. Like I'm happy that you're happy.
Mm.
And you mean it, you don't just say it. Okay, the fourth quality of true love that we should be developing through our practice is called upeksha. Upeksha means equanimity. It's a our ability to move through the world in a way that is calm and relaxed and unaffected.
Mm.
That no matter what the state of the world is around us, we're equanimous, we're smooth, we're cool.
It's kind of like the state of homeostasis that
you
go into stress but it doesn't affect you, and that you can come out as easily as you went in and rest in that state of balance and reset the body.
Yeah, so upeksha is a regulated nervous system.
Yeah. That's so funny
that that we can just remain in a state of balance so that we can love the people around us.
Totally. And the way I've been sharing these four qualities of love in my classes and my offerings at the studio this last couple of weeks has been that once we are able to take the space and the time to rest and to nourish ourselves in a way that is nurturing and supportive of ourselves, that not only do these qualities of love arise naturally within us, but they arise naturally for us to share with others as well, meaning that they shouldn't have to be a chore and they shouldn't have to be something you check off the list or something that you feel guilty if you don't feel, but it's something that can, you know, is natural birthright to us, that we should be able to feel these feelings. But sometimes all we need is to take a step back from the busyness and the craziness of life and the expectations of society and just take some time to nourish yourself in whatever way works, even if it's 5 minutes. Of stillness or 5 minutes of pranayama or 5 minutes of an oil massage, you know, just taking that time to be present with yourself, be accepting of yourself, and then the four qualities of love will naturally arise from that place.
Yeah, think of them like a siddhi,
a gift
that's given through your practice, that you practice in a way that is loving and love will be the result of your practice.
Totally.
It will be the fruit of the practice.
Mm.
And everyone around you will get to enjoy it.
Mm.
So get loving. That's all that we have for you today. We appreciate you joining us for the podcast. And We would love to know how the video format's going. Because this is a little bit of a new process for us. We thought it might be a little bit more interactive. Plus, we get a little bit of extra content for social media. So let us know if you're enjoying it. Mm-hmm. And there's only one thing that we ask of you. For us giving out this free content, we put so many hours into the podcast. All that we ask is that you share it with someone that you think could benefit from it. Share it on your story, send it to your friend, especially your yoga friends. Mm. We just want to make knowledge accessible. We want to make yoga accessible. And so the best way that you can support us in doing this is by sharing this, liking the podcast on Spotify, following, rating, whatever. Do the thing that you're meant to do on whatever platform you are listening on.
Mm.
And we'd love it if you came and practiced with us.
Yeah, we have an in-person studio in Berwick, Victoria, Australia. We also have our online yoga studio and a range of different online offerings, including our 100-hour online self-paced Hatha yoga training. So if you're interested in starting to dive deeper into the practices, into the philosophy, then that's definitely an option. We'll have the links in the show notes below. But yeah, we have something for everyone. So if you like our content, just go have a browse through our website. There's so much on there.
Yeah. Hari Om.
Hari Om.